begin to look all that easy. When you have won, you suddenly become conscious of the divisions in your own ranks, for example. There is an absolutely apocryphal story, sure it must be apocryphal, which in the confidence of this room I shall tell you about the question that was put in private to the Prime Minister after she'd been in for about 6 months. And someone came up to her and said, well, Margaret, how's it going? And she said, oh, it's going quite well. If I could get rid of the cabinet and the civil service, it'd be absolutely perfect. Well, here you have a rather better system, and you're not so encumbered. I mean, in England, we have this great conception of the impartial and independent civil service, which is meant to sit there and take a critical, historical, permanent view of the policies of successive governments. In fact, what it is a college of well-established gentlemen who have developed their own theory of government, which naturally puts the civil service at the centre, and who are resolved to defend every inch of the territory which they have conquered from previous governments. Well, you don't have that difficulty, but you have all the other difficulties. And my God, when you have heard the admirable lectures delivered at this conference in the last 24 hours, how can anybody but a very strong man fail to be daunted? For the balance of world power assuredly is against us. We have years and years of neglect, and worse than neglect, to repair. In fact, I kept on being reminded of another apocryphal story about two of our great leaders during the war, a story of Winston Churchill having a conversation one afternoon with General Eisenhower, and they both sat down together and reviewed the situation. And then it is alleged Winston turned to Eisenhower and said, well, what do you think are the chances of our winning this war? And Eisenhower said, negligible. And Winston said, I agree entirely. And then after a few minutes' reflection, looking at his watch, Winston said, well then, we better go and win it. And that is the kind of reaction of faith which is prompted in some of us by the kind of diagnosis we have had today. However, and yesterday, and last night particularly, however, what I can report to you is that there is spirit and determination in Britain, that we are certainly resolved to go ahead, and that we are vastly encouraged by the turn that you have taken in the same direction. I shall bear back tidings of great comfort from this visit here. Now, having said that, you will understand that anything that follows in this lecture, which may seem, in this talk, let us not be pretentious, that may seem to be remotely critical of the American tradition, in fact springs from nothing but love and admiration. What I want to talk about today is the connection between ethics and foreign policy. And I have to tell you, John has already indicated it, that not only am I an English conservative, but I'm not even a member of what is called the New Right in England. I'm the Old Right. I'm the sort of chap who has regretted almost everything that happened, I'm not going to say since 1776, since 1832, I will prove this is my, as my dividing line. And therefore, as far as my thinking about foreign policy is concerned, my great models and preceptors are Castlereagh and Canning and Salisbury and Balfour and Austen Chamberlain. And I'm going to suggest that although many of the axioms of that old-fashioned Tory foreign policy are now out of date, some of them may still in some degree be relevant and be worthy even of your consideration. What then is that tradition of foreign policy? Well, it is essentially a tradition that is critical of, the liberal rationalistic approach to foreign affairs. What I mean by the liberal rationalistic approach to foreign affairs is the view that there is some sovereign panacea which dispenses, really, with the need for thinking about foreign policy at all. Some principle of universal application which is given directly to reason and which suggests itself in every case the manner of its application, and that all you have to do is go about applying this principle single-mindedly throughout the entire world, and you will be absolutely okay. That I take to be the liberal rationalist tradition of foreign policy, as expressed by me in an insulting and oversimplified form, but nevertheless a form which I would say was roughly and in general accurate. And we've seen throughout British history, and I don't know anything about anybody else's history, throughout British history we have seen a series of applications of this manner of thinking about foreign policy. In the 17th century, the sovereign principle was the support of the cause of Protestantism, the ideological support of Protestantism in Europe. In the 19th century, it was the political support of the parliamentary liberal ideology, the support for liberal institutions wherever they existed, the support for people who were trying to establish liberal institutions wherever such people existed. And indeed, we lavishly gave in our country at that time encouragement to a large number of revolutionary movements, leading them to expect that they would receive massive and material support from Britain, which they seldom did receive, getting in the process a very bad name for letting people down. Well, then that was followed by another sovereign principle in this liberal rationalist tradition. It was really the economic principle of the universal value, the supreme value of the panacea of free trade. There was a notion that set in about the middle of the 19th century, Cobden was its great exponent, that really if you could only get free trade, then you really needn't bother with a foreign policy or an army or a navy or anything of that kind. This was all perfectly worked out on sound philosophical principles. The premise was that the supreme governing motive in everybody's conduct was the desire for material gain, that if you got free trade, there would be such a degree of economic interdependence throughout the world. Everybody's interests would be so intertwined that the world could absolutely never afford another World War, and of course quite a considerable advance, another war, advance had been made in this direction by the beginning of the 20th century. So considerable an advance that there was a very famous series of lectures delivered in Cambridge by a great progressive liberal economist called Sir Norman Angell, who demonstrated that the advance towards economic interdependence achieved by the spread of free trade had already reached a point at which further wars would be totally impossible. And the date on which those lectures were delivered was July 1914. Well, then this was followed afterwards, of course, by the other panacea, collective security. The notion that if you would only treat an attack on any state in the world as an attack on every state in the world, you could have a judicially enforceable system of law. This presupposed that the good and law-abiding powers would always be more numerous and stronger than the bad powers. And, of course, it failed. It also supposed that you could construct an international system based on equality of votes and equality of deciding power between states of vastly different resources, so that great powers would allow themselves to be voted into wars for which they would have to provide the money and the manpower by small powers who were incapable of making very much contribution to collective defense. And of course that ended in disillusion and disaster as well. And that was succeeded by the new version of the panacea, a slightly more realistic version, the United Nations Charter, which overcame this difficulty of the inequality of strength between the powers by simply endowing all those powers against whom military action might have to be taken with the power to veto such action against themselves. So it has been a long record of disillusion. And finally, at the very end of this liberal rationalist tradition comes the phase of human rights through which we have been living in the last few years. Now, this, of course, rests on the notion that it is possible to arrive at the conclusion that all men are born free and equal, and that this implies that they have certain concrete rights which should be universally enforced, and that the great principle of foreign policy must be to give support to these rights. This is open to a whole lot of objections. Of course, it's really open, in the first place, to a philosophical objection. Because although you may believe that there is such a thing as a jus gentium, you may believe that if you look at the customs and manners and principles of all men at all times, you will be able to deduce from that some common body of agreement about human rights. That body of agreement will be, in fact, so slender and abstract that it will not provide any effective guide to political action at all. It is also open to the objection that when we start intervening in the affairs of other powers, with the most benevolent intentions, we very frequently get our assessments of who is what and what is going on completely wrong. And this is particularly so in our own day when, as you have repeatedly pointed out, both the British and the American peoples have totally lost the capacity to distinguish between friend and foe. So a great deal of confusion results from the human rights principle. It's also open to the objection, of course, that it can operate in such a way as to encourage people with good causes to rebel against impossible odds, and that we then stand by and let them get mown down. It's also open to the objection that it prevents the honest discussion of foreign policy in any sort of strategic terms. You've got to turn absolutely everything into a moral issue. You have got to convince yourself that all your allies are good and that all your enemies are quite unequivocally bad. You can't say, I'm going to defend Afghanistan because if that goes, there will be a considerable danger to our supplies of oil in the Middle East, and that this will be a great threat to the Western world and to humanity at large. You can't say that. You have to say that you are defending the people of Afghanistan because they are a peace-loving and democratically-minded nation. That was never the British experience of them over a period of years. I can tell you that. And, of course, the particular regime that is established there now, even before the Russians went in, is a Soviet regime. And, in fact, the real trouble about this doctrine of human rights as a guide to foreign policy, the real criticism of it, is not practical, but moral, because there is a terrible nemesis attaching to it, sir. The truth is that if you start trying to conduct foreign policy in this wicked world, on the assumption that you can only deal, only have the good as allies and the bad as evil, you will end simply by convincing yourself that whoever you are obliged to have as an ally is good, and whoever you are obliged to oppose is bad. And only the second half of that proposition is really likely in this world to prove correct. It leads to the atrophy of the conscience. It leads to the bending of moral principles to support expedient causes. I'd like to give you two vivid illustrations of what I mean. One is very near to my heart, and I was damn well determined to find an excuse for bringing it in, sir. That is the decision of your government in the name of human rights to ban the sale of arms to the Royal Ulster Constabulary. Well, there's no need for John O'Sullivan to get nervous. I'm not, in fact, going to embark on a long analysis of the condition of Northern Ireland. All I'm going to say is that here you have in progress a terrorist war which is being waged by a small minority for the purpose of obliging a majority to accept a political allegiance which it rejects, that this minority is working hand in glove with every left-wing terrorist organization in Europe, that it is committing the most appalling crimes, and that the British government, with the most saintly restraint, is doing its very best to try and bring that situation under control. And yet your doctrine of human rights, as represented by the Carter, as accepted by the Carter administration, obliges you to treat our police force there as though it was another terrorist gang. Well, I would not be telling you the truth, sir, and I would be yielding to the seduction of all this magnificent hospitality if I did not report to you that that is a state of affairs which my fellow countrymen most warmly resent, and which, so long as it survives, will continue to be one of the few obstacles to the total friendship of our two countries. But having had the impertinence to make that statement, let me give you another example of how the doctrine of human rights has operated malignly when applied by the British government. And there is no more classic case of it than in our handling of Rhodesia, sir. Because if there is one indisputable political fact, it is that Britain is absolutely powerless to influence for good the future development of Central Africa. However, committed to our liberal imperialist tradition and to the doctrine of human rights, we felt obliged to pretend that we could so influence it. Mm. So we went in there, all grand and in a vice-regal manner, just like the old days. It was a wonderful sort of piece of nostalgia for the British people to have governors general and so forth going out there and putting the world to rights. But what we did when we got there was simply to accept the facts, the political facts, which was that a pair of terrorist organisations had won the war. We decided, therefore, to cloak their power with authority, to facilitate the process of their completing their victory, to discourage all those who might oppose them. We did it all in the name of the doctrine of human rights. And this is a great illustration of my theory of the nemesis in this matter, of how it is that you start with these absolutely pure principles and how you end. Because politics is a matter of compromise and power in bending your principles to the realities. And that really seems to me to be the main message about the ethics of foreign policy. So what would I like to see, sir? Am I recommending a policy of pure self-interest? Well, no, I'm not. But I must say I should be very relieved if I thought that the primary consideration in the formation of United States foreign policy in the future would be the interests of the United States of America. Because unless those are secure, you can do nothing whatsoever. I should be immensely relieved, sir, if instead of a revival of liberal idealism in this country, even genuine liberal idealism, not the corrupt kind we have seen in recent years, you were to have a revival of patriotism, because I think patriotism is the impulse upon which the defense of the Western world depends. When I was listening to last night's talk about the extent to which we are all penetrated at this moment by the Soviet Union, I suddenly thought, now, how did this come about? I don't think it came about really simply by bribery and coercion, though that has played its part in the penetration of the media and civil services and so on. I think it really dates from the middle of the last war, when, under the influence of liberal and internationalist thinking, we began to talk in terms of an international civil war. We were supposed to be fighting not for Britain, not for the United States of America, but for a universal cosmopolitan cause. And because Russia was on our side, Russia was on our side of the barricades. And it was at that stage that quite civilized, confused young men in the Foreign Office and elsewhere got it into their heads that the objections to the revealing of secrets and so on were now totally out of date because we were living through a civil war, not a nasty old-fashioned clash of nations or imperialisms. So I would welcome a revival of patriotism. I would also welcome a revival of realism. I should like to be assured that with your great influence on the world, and we all depend upon you, you had not only a determination to match your responsibilities with power, but also a recognition that this is a thing that nobody can ever wholly succeed in doing, or at any rate matching their ideals with power, that one has to decide in this world what is defensible and what is indefensible, I mean in the material and strategic sense, that one has to recognize that in the process of defending what has to be defended, one must make expedient alliances with people whose political systems may not be entirely to one's taste, that in the process of postponing war, or let us be crude and realistic, putting ourselves in the best position to win war, one has to negotiate with powers whose systems one wholly disapproves. All these things you should do, and you can do without compromising the moral purpose of American foreign policy, which is surely to defend what remains of the free world, to provide to the world a perpetual example of freedom, to use every judicious and discreet peaceful means of extending the influence of our Western ideas and civilization. But this, I think, will be better done by a power which is grounded its foreign policy on realism than by a power which attempts to build that foreign policy on doctrines as flimsy and deceptive as those of universal human rights. And I can tell you, sir, that if such a patriotic America with a realistic foreign policy is going to emerge again, then we in Britain, at any rate, will say with more confidence than we've been able to since 1940, the light is from the West. Thank you very much.
Well, it sounds as if you said everything there was to be said, and the audience recognized it. So, in that case, I'll thank you again on behalf of everyone, and say how much we've enjoyed it and benefited from that, and we look forward to seeing you frequently in the future.
Well,
a luncheon is adjourned.
Well, thank you very much, sir. I think the evidence is rather the audience is exhausted rather than. but I am. Most grateful to you, and I have learned an enormous amount from these sessions in the last 24 hours, and I'm deeply grateful for your hospitality and all the intellectual nourishment. Thank you very much indeed.
I love that.